ship is slowly sinking. While you were looking at the stars, the men all snuck off drinking. There's not been wind in the sails for days to keep us going. So while you were looking at the stars, your ship was overflowing. Oh, captain, my captain, your men are slowly drowning. Can't you feel beneath the floor the screaming and the pounding? The mast is falling on the hatch, there is no escape. So while you were looking at the stars, they met a watery grave.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Colin?
Comics or graphic novels, if you want to be.
I use the comic term. I'm old school. Oh, I didn't even turn your mic on. There we go.
Okay. Oh, is my mic on now?
Hot mic.
What?
Nothing. Yeah, that mic is working quite well. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was trying to explain to someone the other day, just like, you know, and now that they're graphic novels, and I'm like, you know, it's basically like saying the difference between like a short story and a novel. It's still words and pictures. And so we're not, I'll stop my diatribe now. I'm going to save the whole world from my rants. I think Colin's heard probably enough to last a lifetime, and he's already falling asleep. Okay, Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. This is the radio show about comics. We are broadcasting from UBC out in Vancouver. It's feels like a fall day today, even though it's not fall. I don't know why. Please excuse my voice. I have some horrible illness that's been beating me down, so hopefully Colin will be able to make up for my inadequacies.
I'll try.
You'll try. Our guest today, I'm bringing him on the air now, is Mr. Jason Lutz. Jason, I have been a fan of his work for quite some time. His main stuff is... Oh, this is sounding noisy. How am I sounding there, Jason?
Yeah, it's pretty distorted.
It's pretty distorted.
Or maybe distorted is not the right word, but you're really fuzzy.
I'm fuzzy. I am. That is not good. Okay. I was pre-warned... And I don't know how this sounds to folks listening, but I feel like I'm, you know, when like someone gets throat cancer, does it kind of sound like that with the?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it sounds like.
A voice box.
How does Colin sound?
I sound kind of fuzzy too.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it manageable?
Well, do I sound okay?
You sound great. You're wonderful. So
yeah, I guess we could plow ahead. I may have to ask you to repeat something from time to time.
I'll try and be succinct and,
to the point.
To the point. There we go. No Canadian overloaded questions. as I was saying, Jason's main books, you have a handful now. a year ago, not as much. Over last year, you've released Houdini the Handcuff King, illustrated by the very talented Nick Bertuzzi, as well as book two of three, I guess, of Berlin, The City of Smoke. Book one came out. We won't even say when the first book came out. And as well as the first stuff I read by you, which is quite excellent, which is what really hooked me on, Jar of Fools, which is a sad little book.
Thank you.
So, I guess we'll start out with history. You seem to love history in all of your work I read.
Yeah.
What draws you into writing about history?
I see it less as writing about history and more as sort of writing about the world. And as sometimes a historical lens is a good one to look through. To, you know, when you stand at a distance from something, you can see it in a different way than when it's all around you. And I think that looking at things in the past, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and we all have a different perspective on things that happened than the people who actually experienced them at the time. But I think that having that distance is a really interesting, it has an interesting effect on trying to tell a story, and the challenge, the imaginative challenge of trying to insert yourself into a different place and time is one that I really enjoy a lot. They're Houdini and Berlin are historically based, but like history in and of itself is not like something that, you know, I'm drawn to. It's just that these times and places and the people in them were what I found interesting, as opposed to, you know, like the past in general.
Colin had a question and then he disappeared. I turned the mic right down because of the sound problems. Am I still audible?
Yeah, you're still audible.
Okay. Oh, there we go.
Colin. I remember now. Okay, I was just, I remember when Berlin first came out, and I looked at it, and I thought, wow, you really set yourself up a difficult task here. I mean, it's such a complicated period, place and time. Well, did you find that at all daunting?
In a way, the harder it is to, like, to boil it down, the harder it is to actually... you know, to summarize something, the more, the kind of easier it is, because I feel like it's sort of like I had this experience of seeing, you know, I started the book and I worked on it for probably 4 years before I actually set foot in the actual city. And before I actually went to Berlin, the real place, I was sort of terrified because I had this imaginary version of the city, and then I was worried that seeing the thing on the ground, the real thing, would totally shatter my version of it. And the thing I realized seeing the real place is that it was so much more kind of rich and wonderful and beautiful than anything I could possibly make, that there was nothing to worry about. You know what I mean? It's there's just when the gulf between what you're trying to accomplish as an artist and the thing itself is so vast that you can just be content with sitting on your side of it. And that's kind of how I feel about the complicated. There was no way, you know, I've read a lot about it. I've totally followed all the different threads of all the different, you know, cultural, socio-political, like all the different factors that fed into that time, and tried to like take it apart and figure out how different things worked. And ultimately, you're right. It's a super complicated. You know, it's a big mess. And I'm not. What I realize is that my goal is not to like summarize and find answers. My goal was more to explore. I think the exploration. That's sort of the motivating principle of all my work. Is I'm trying to. I am attracted to something and I want to explore it. And exploration, in its very nature, is not a place where you're trying to. It's not a state where you're. You're going to necessarily impose a shape or order on something. You're going to, I mean, maybe you can make a map as you explore, you know, but the map's not the territory. And so with that mindset, I think that the complicated thing, all the complicated stuff is just like, those are the environmental factors of the world that my imagination's entering into. And I'm going to like try to find, the shape I'm trying to find is of some kind of story, but I'm not trying to like make, you know, perfect sense out of all of it. If that's a, long-winded answer to a simple question.
I think one thing I'd like to maybe just toss in there for a second, if you can explain to people the era that you're covering with Berlin so people have a good idea of why is this so complex?
it takes place in the city of Berlin, Germany. The story starts in 1928 and it will end in 1933 when Hitler assumes the chancellorship. And it was post World War I. People were trying to figure out how to make a republic work in the vacuum left by a monarchy, which is historically always proven a challenge. And there were, because of where it was positioned geographically, there were all kinds of, you know, there was a heavy communist influence. And because after the war and in the kind of the void left by the war, all of these forces kind of flooded in to try to, like, seize control of what was happening, you know, of the people's attention, essentially. And so there were a lot of, you know, there were many, many, there was, like, something like 29 different political parties in the Reichstag. And, yeah, it's crazy. And that's actually one of the things that Hitler used to his advantage at the time, was to say, like, when he was, you know, exhorting the masses, he would say, there are 29 political parties in the Reichstag. Like, can you believe how absurd that is? Whereas, you know, like a populist would say, well, that's great. There's the voices for all these different factions. And it proved to be, that's just one aspect in which it was very complicated. So my story's about a cast of characters from different social strata who are trying to make their way in the world, and they don't know, you know, they don't know how the story turns out. And the objective for me as the author is to try not to, like, I mean, there's a little bit of foreshadowing. There's some kind of gloomy, doomy stuff going on, but I try not to, like, I try as much as possible not to let my knowledge about how things turned out affect my characters' lives. I try to allow them to make their way through the city from day to day, just dealing with what's right in front of them.
So, is it difficult finding a balance between the story and the characters, and explaining some of the background of the political story?
I trust a lot of that to the reader to kind of try to figure out themselves on their own time. There is like a fair amount of exposition, which I think in the earlier chapters, it's like kind of that kind of painful exposition, you know, where characters who know the subject really well talk about it as if they don't know it very well, which we're all familiar with from, like, bad novels and films. So I try to a little bit, you know, for the more complicated stuff, I try to, like, explain for the lay reader. But for the most part, I try to, like, just try to write as if the people talking know what they're talking about and don't, you know, over-explain things, and trust that if the reader's interested at all, then they can go do some homework, you know, and figure out the specifics. But the story is not, you know, it's not supposed to be a detailed account of, like, the different political relationships. And in this last volume, it got pretty complicated with the organization of the presidency and all this stuff. And I went maybe a little too much into that, because the goal, you know, I don't want to overburden people with that. I'm more interested in what happens to the characters, and I want to get the readers interested in specifically, you know, the characters' motivations and you know, what's going to happen to them. So it's definitely like, but, you know, at the same time, I don't want to leave that stuff out, because it's a really huge part of the context. And I think that people can work a little bit. You know, I want the reader to work a little bit. You know, there's like a level of work. You don't want them to work too hard, because then you, like, put up a wall and it pushes them away. But you don't want to spoon feed them, because then you're not making them. They absorb it, and then they walk away and they don't remember anything. But if you make them work a little bit, if you put a couple of speed bumps in there, you know, where they have to stop and think, or they have to, like, take a double take on something you put into a panel. There's this level of interactivity that I'm shooting for, that if you engage the reader enough and make them participate in the story you're telling, then I think that they will be that much more involved, and they'll retain, so it'll stay with them more.
I was just wondering, where are the swastikas?
where are they?
Yeah, I keep seeing these flags with white circles. I went to one of my reference books on German non-Nazi flags, just to try and figure out if this is some sort of early Nazi party flag I'd never come across before.
And Colin doesn't joke about having a reference book on early.
Yeah,
Nazi
no,
flags.
I know. I know Colin's reputation. So I like how you said you went through one of your reference books about German flags.
I
see a whole
three.
Bookshelf of German flag reference.
I only have three.
You've only got three?
Yeah.
But
well,
it's
made
in,
you look.
it's in the bookshelf of different international flags.
and the armbands. They're the...
Yeah. Yeah, well, I left them out. They're not there.
Why?
Because I think it's too loaded of a symbol, and that if you see that on the page, the, first of all, when you turn a page, if you saw, you know, your eye would immediately jump to it, and it sets up all these. It has this, you know, this incredibly powerful, probably, you know, of all the symbols in history, perhaps besides the cross or the crescent. It has an incredibly powerful resonance, and at the time, it didn't. You know, at the time, it simply did not. It was still relatively new. I mean, the symbol itself had been around for, of course, centuries, but its usage and its implications to the people on the street at the time were nowhere near what they were now, what they are now. So that was a very, very conscious effort to take out that, to excise that hot button, you know. I don't want to telegraph anything about that. I want people to engage with and understand the people who are walking around in uniform on a different way than they would if they saw that swastika flying over their heads. Because today, looking back, you know, it has a completely different meaning to us. And it's funny because if you ask people, if you took a poll of people who read the book, many of them will swear to you that there are swastikas. Because they, and this is the thing, this is that interactivity I was talking about, like you said, there's a white circle on a black flag, and the black is just, you know, it's a black and white comic, so that's just a device for having it be red. And in that sense, I'm also kind of grateful it's a black and white comic because by making the choice to make it black, you know, if it was red and white, then it would be closer to the classic symbolism. So, but there's these empty white circles, and what happens is people project the swastikas in there. Their little mind's eye, you know, just boom, it's there. And if you... I've had people at conventions, you know, swear to me and, like, paw through the book trying to point to a swastika.
On page 33.
And it's really gratifying because that means that it's... I mean, also, it's a really telling because it tells you how powerful that symbol is. That, you know, you put enough of those cues in there, like the way that the brown shirt uniforms look or whatever, and people will just start to see swastikas. And on the individual chapters, and Colin, I know you have some of the individual issues, right?
All of them.
Yeah, so, and you know the trick about if you open one up and lay it flat, and you open up another one and overlap them, you can actually make a swastika off out of the design.
Oh.
And no, that's, the only, that's the only, that's a subconscious hint that there's swastikas in there.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
Neat trick. It's sort of like the old, remember the fold-ins in the old Mad magazine.
I don't think you'll ever see El Jafei making something with swastikas. Speaking of symbolism, you don't actually use much symbolism at all. Like, a couple of times you have the one where the person discusses the hammer and sickle, and
yeah.
But it's very minimal any other symbols are used, I find.
Yeah,
like it's very plain. Is that continuously conscious from the pulling out the swastikas, or?
No, it's not. You know, I don't think it is. I think generally thinking about it, like symbols are dangerous because for the reasons that I already talked about, and that they are a really quick and easy way to kind of, you know, their way of generalizing essentially. And I'm more interested in the complicated. Underlying things than that symbol that sits on top.
Well, I suppose it's hard not to pigeonhole the characters according to their political affiliation.
Right, exactly, yeah. And a lot of them would be happy to pigeonhole, but other ones, for other people, it's a little more complicated, you know? With somebody who's a member of the Communist Party in 1928, there's a pretty broad range of people there. It's not all... who you might expect it to be.
They're not all Trotskyites.
Right, exactly, right. They're not all Trotskyites.
Now, just kind of steering away from the discussion of, and we'll probably talk more about the politics and stuff, is right off the bat, you start off the story with these two characters. One's a writer, one's an artist.
Yeah.
Tell me about that purposeful placement as a cartoonist.
Well, in the beginning, I knew that the story was going to happen in Berlin in the 20s, and I didn't really know. I needed, like, some people to follow through. I needed two main characters, and I chose them for precisely that reason, that one of them is, one of them uses words and one of them uses pictures. And I wanted to, you know, at first I thought about having their relationship be kind of metaphorical, about the relationship between words and pictures, because that's the meat and potatoes of this medium. And, but then, you know, they just became people, and I tried to figure out how they would feel about each other and how they would grow and change. And you know, still trying to, like, keep present the idea that that's how they express themselves through their, you know, through drawing or writing. And so now at this point, I don't, you know, that relationship doesn't have any connection to comics itself other than, you know, incidentally, I think in their relationship you could draw some connections. But it started out as a conscious decision for exactly, you know, like you're good to notice it. A lot of people don't even notice that. But now they're just characters doing their thing, sleeping with lesbians and burning their books.
Yeah, I'm sitting on the bus reading it, and of course that I open up to the whole Coke orgy scene. Oh, we'll just close that.
That's a big problem with comics right there.
Exactly. Like, yeah. If I was reading Bukowski or, you know, someone, they wouldn't notice what's going on. You know,
Or
some Burroughs or something.
Well, you can't do interwar Berlin without a little decadence now, could you?
No, you got to have it in there. I didn't want to go overboard because that's been, you know, that's been... that's what people think about, really, when they think about Berlin then. But I had to touch on it, so that was my attempt.
How do you find yourself as a creator leaking into the characters?
You know, in Jar of Fools, after I finished Jar of Fools, which was not historically based, it was very much like set in a fictional city that was a combination of Providence, Rhode Island, and Seattle. And it was very much about the present. It was about the rain-soaked Northwest, which you guys know very well.
Mm.
In retrospect, I realized it was really an examination. You know, it was totally personal and totally internal. It was very much about processing my own feelings about people and a relationship I'd been in and what it meant to be who I was then. And with Berlin, I really consciously set out to have it be about other people, to have it be about people who are different from me. You know, the two main characters that we just talked about, one's a writer and one's an artist, and in a sense they do represent, you know, I use those parts of me to try to figure out who they are, and all of the characters, of course, are going to be informed by who I am, because they are my creations, and I can't help but be in them to some degree, but I do put a lot of conscious effort into, I think the act of, like, empathy, even for fictional characters, is a really important one, and I try as much as I can to imagine people with other kinds of lives and other motivations than those I might have, and trying to imagine how they would behave in different situations. Like Kurt, for instance, the main character, there's a point in which he gets really angry at Marta, who is the artist, and he gets mad at her because she's playing her jazz records too loud. and that's not really me at all, you know, like, a lot of Kurt is definitely me. A lot of things he says and thinks, like, a lot of the kind of purple prose passages that he has are my worst, you know, me at my worst kind of sentimental self, and I recognize that. But there are also places where I feel like, you know what, Kurt, this is how Kurt would feel, and I wouldn't feel that way. But he'd be like, he sees jazz as, like, just another indication that things are going to hell, you know, just another... and, you know, because it was, like, considered to be the, you know, music of the Dark Continent and primitive, you know, like, this kind of basic, like, people dancing to jazz was, like, a very, like, disturbing thing to a lot of people.
Well, it was kind of an affluent, you know,
yeah.
statement of, you know, look at us. We don't worry. We just jazz.
Right, right, right. Exactly. And, of course, jazz, you know, one of the supposed origins of the term is that it means fuck. Oh, can I say that on the radio?
Sure.
In Canada?
It's student radio. So.
We won't have any Nipplegate problems here. In fact, Colin's showing his nipple right now.
Ah!
There we go.
Is it difficult for you to put yourself in the shoes of a national socialist or a hardcore communist?
No, it's not. I don't find those. When it comes right down to it, like they're all people drawn from the human race, and you can see the same motivations in like a thousand different guises throughout history and present to this day. You know, like they just have specific names associated with them, and in both cases, you know, under Stalin or under Hitler, like incredible. Horrible things were done, but the quantity and depth of horror is not. I don't see that as like a kind of uniquely distinguishing characteristic of those kinds of that kind of mindset. You know, like I've seen, there's been an incredible nationalist fervor here after 9/11, which was really disturbing. You know, if you can remember, but at least you know at its worst it's had some horrible effects, but. But on the lighter end of the scale, you got wonderful things like Freedom Fries. you know, like it just
they changed the name back after Sarkozy.
What would they call a poutine then?
Freedom Mush.
Sorry, that was a particularly Canadian question.
Freedom Curds.
Freedom Curds. I was actually going to ask you if you saw parallels between the Weimar period and Dick Cheney's America.
yeah, sure, absolutely. But in the specifics, things are, you know, very, very different. There are parallels, but it is not like a, you know, it's not at like two simultaneous, perfectly reflected trajectories. There's
Well, they never are.
Right, exactly. They never are. There are places where the things come close together and you can just hear the kind of the resonating hum of horror. but there absolutely are parallels. And, you know, when it comes right down to it, when I look back, when you talk about, like, well, how do you put yourself in the mindset of a Nazi or a communist? And then, like, we were talking earlier about symbols and the power of symbols. I'm just interested in stripping that stuff away and getting at what it is that makes people do what they do, and people have been doing the same kinds of things throughout history, and generally they're motivated by the basest of emotions, you know, greed, power, lust, whatever you want to, however you want to break them down, seven deadly sins, and those same motivations are what's driving the world today. I mean, the economic crisis, you know, same stuff, same basic stuff. And what's fascinating is the human effort to try to overcome that through things like policy and government and organized society, and then the tendency to completely sabotage that, you know? Like, you know, our most esteemed politicians in this country being tax evaders is a really great. It's just kind of, you know, there's a level of absurdity that it boggles the mind, really.
I guess power, ultimate power corrupts, or... with great power comes great responsibility.
Both of any of those mainstream comics one-liners you want to throw in there will work.
Actually, I've seen a remarkable small amount of power corrupt people.
Right. Just get somebody, like your supervisor at the deli will be a little mini Stalin.
If you can... Colin, I'm turning off your mic.
Hey.
I'm going to do a quick song break.
Okay.
I think we're going to play the Bonnie Prince Billy.
Okay.
And we'll be right back. Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking to Jason Litz.
And it's a hard life for a man with no wife. Babe, it's a hard life God makes you live. But without it, don't doubt it, you don't even have your tears to give. I wake up and I'm fine, with my dreaming still on my mind.
but it don't take long, you see, for the demons to come and visit me. And I've got my problems, sometimes love don't solve them, and I end each day in a song. And it's a hard life for a man with no why. Lord, it's a hard life. God makes you live, but without it, baby, don't doubt it. You don't even have your tears to give. I'm a hard man to live with sometimes. Maybe it ain't in me to make you a happy wife of mine. And maybe you'll kill me. Honey, I don't blame you. If I was in your place, maybe that's what I would do. But I ain't breathing. Let me breathe. Let me go. Let me leave. I don't know, but I might lose. I might bum my head to blow a fuse. So let me go. Lay down.
CITR 101.9 FM. Oh, I forgot we're still really quiet. Ink Studs. And actually, I'm going to bring us right back down because there we go. Hoo-wah. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, in fact, you sound much better than before.
There we go. Yeah, but if I go back up.
Oh, there you go. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, hello. I am calling from the year 2009. Vancouver is crumbling in the preparations for an Olympics.
Oh, don't get me started. Hey, do you want the Olympics?
Do what?
Do you want the Olympics?
Do I want the Olympics?
Yeah, we're thinking of sending it elsewhere.
No, thank you.
Oh.
I don't really care for the Olympics.
Neither do we. That's the problem.
I was thinking of renting out my apartment to a bunch of tourists, but I really don't want to have to worry about my books. Isn't that lame? Is there something wrong with me?
Well, I'm worried about my cat.
My cat will be fine. My cat's mean. People stay away from my cat. It's got a reputation. Ink Studs, I'm talking to Jason Lutz. We've been yakking about Merlin. The second book just came out from Drowning Quarterly, I guess, within the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think September was when it came out.
September. And it's a fabulous book. It's an investment to sit down and read.
Well, it's taken me freaking 12 years so far, so it better be an investment.
It seems like I'm curious about plotting out the story and how it's changed from when you started it to where you're at now, because you're still adding new characters, it seems like, and stories still keep diverging and going in their different directions and stuff. So I'm wondering how that's changed from original intention.
Yeah, when I set out, I had a whole, like, I had a I looked through books of photographs, and I had like a list of characters that I wanted to play around with, and several of them fell by the wayside. There was a boxer based on Max Schmeling that never made it in, probably won't. And it's definitely evolved over time. And, you know, it's great because I was talking about exploration before, and one of the fun things that can happen is, you know, I'll write a scene, and the characters will walk down the street. The main characters will walk down the street, and they'll pass somebody, and then I'll say, hey, wait, who's that person, you know? and then I'll go ahead and follow them and see where their story takes me. And it's the kind of thing that can only happen. I mean, I was, you know, writers can do the same thing with prose, but when you're drawing it, when you're creating this visual environment and you put the characters in it, you can look at that environment and you can say, hey, what about that? You know, what if I go around that corner or through that door? When you create that visual element, there are these little cues that your imagination can take and run with. So a lot of the characters have come out of that. They've kind of evolved from, like, Gudrun Brown, the working class mother who is a sort of becomes a main character in the first volume. She originally was just like you were just supposed to sort of follow her on her way to work, and then you were supposed to never see her again. But she turned into a really big part of the story, and now her daughter is a big part of the story. And that's they're people I never imagined at the beginning. And then the whole second volume is sort of framed by this American jazz band that comes, and that's pretty much it for them. The whole second volume is pretty much all you'll see of them. And then the last volume, I don't think there's going to be any more new characters, or if they are, they'll be very minor. It's going to be pretty much focusing in on Sylvia and David. Sylvia, the orphan child of the working class mother I just talked about, and David is this Jewish kid who she sort of shacks up with, and Kurt and Marta, and Otto, this communist street fighter guy. So it's going to be like the half a dozen probably of them for the final haul, and it's plotted out. I've got all the signposts, and I just have to like find my way between them basically.
It really, when I was reading Berlin, I was getting kind of alarmed. It was like, wow, you see someone on the street scene and the story could follow them at anybody in the street. The story would be following them. And it was like, this really shouldn't work as well as it does. Do you spend a lot of time plotting out to keep it all straight and coherent?
Yeah, I do. Oh, yeah. There's like, you know, outlines, and you know, every chapter when I write it, it's all thumbnailed, and I'll cut out scenes, and but I think part of the reason it works, if it does work, and I think a lot of people, you'll actually, if you talk to people, I think a lot of readers would say it doesn't work because they're not used to stories like that. It's a very non-traditional narrative that way. You know, as I've already expressed, like I have this, I'm really interested in people and what motivates them, and you know, there's so many different kinds of us, et cetera. And I think that interest is like an unspoken theme of the story. And then when the quote unquote camera, you know, shifts and you follow somebody that you didn't expect to follow, it ties into that there's this, that underlying concern. So I think that hopefully it all feels like it, you know, works, but it will definitely challenge your,
cognitive recognition.
yes. Well, there's that. Also, being able to draw distinctive characters is always a challenge. Trying to make them realistic, but not, you know, that it makes you very aware of the comics shorthand that people adapt, where, you know, this, like, all different shaped noses. You know, like if you read Hergé, you know, he's got a pretty abstract drawing style, and the main way he distinguishes people, it's, you know. There's very rarely, like, actually, like, stocky or fat people in Hergé, but it's mainly nose shape. And you'll find that common in a lot of, especially European comics. It's a specific way characters' noses are shaped. It's just a really quick, obvious way to distinguish people. It's sort of like the brow ridges in Star Trek The Next Generation.
I must say, it wasn't until I went to France that I really started to get the noses in Asterix.
Yeah, there's some noses over there. They got some noses. So I struggle to like try to make my characters realistic and believable, but I'm also I'm very limited as an artist in terms of what I'm able to convey visually. So keeping them consistent, and then some of them end up looking a little bit like each other, and then it gets a little confusing for people.
I was just wondering, the way the story will follow different characters, does that relate at all to your interest in designing video games? Is that sort of exploration, what's behind the door?
No, more. Both of those things probably go back actually more to, I think at root it's just like trying to keep your imagination alive, you know, when you're a kid and you see what you're staring out into the dark woods and you wonder what's out there, or the monster in the closet, etc. But the video game thing and that specific aspect of my comics probably go more to, from, you know, if I was going to like point to a cultural thing, it would be role-playing games that I grew up playing in the 70s and 80s. Like that, where, you know, you have to like create a world and imagine you're in that world, and you have to be, you know, when you're like the person running one of those role-playing games, you have to be able to adapt to, it's like an improvisational acting exercise. You have to be able to adapt to whatever the players want to do.
I used to run Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, yeah, great. Well, I just ran my students at CCS through Call of Cthulhu. I hadn't actually played a role-playing game in, like, God, I don't know, 15 years, and then... We had the time, and they had the will, so we did it. It was great.
They had the will and the dice.
Before Cthulhu robbed them of it.
Aww. I was at a cartoonist meeting last night, and one of the cartoonists, in his pencil bag with his pens and pencils, had 2 D10s and a D20.
I often walk around with randomizers in my backpack. You never know. You never know when you're going to need them. You know, when Gary Gygax died last year, I brought in all the old wilderness encounter tables where you roll to see what kind of animal you run into or whatever. And I made my students all roll. I said, okay, giant ant. You run into a giant ant. And they were like, they looked at me like mystified. What the hell is he talking about? But I was actually very moved by, you know, Gygax died, and I more than any like celebrity or writer or any famous person dying, like Gary Gygax dying kind of hit me hard. It made me think about, like, you know, what a big impact the Dungeons and Dragons and those games had on me when I was younger. They were a huge, huge part of my creative development. So it was interesting to reflect on that.
Why don't we talk about your students, or maybe comics in general, because you're a teacher at the Center for Cartoon Studies.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff are you teaching there, other than proper usage of a D20?
Important skill. There is no improper usage of a D20. This year I taught, first semester, fall semester, I taught Cartooning Studio, which is basically Comics 101. Last year was my first year teaching, and I taught Cartooning Studio all year long, and I learned a lot from that. It was basically my education, and I inherited the class plan from James Thurm, who you've had on the show, and I took it and adapted it, and then after teaching last year, I felt like, now I can do it for real. You know, no slight to my students last year, because I did the best I could, but this fall semester, I sort of went at it, you know, guns blazing, and... I feel like I got it down. Like I can teach that class. And that's just like, how do you tell stories? You know, it's sequential storytelling. How do you do it? What are the choices you make? It's not so much the practical aspects, like the inking and the penciling. It's more like, what does it mean when you put this picture next to this picture? How do you make, you know, I had them do an exercise where they had to invent emanata, you know, like, you know what emanata are?
No.
Like the little sweat drops that fly, you know, the little symbols you use to convey feelings that characters are having. You know, the little storm cloud over somebody's head, et cetera.
Aren't those also called, no, emoto?
Emoticons? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Or?
Isn't that something you use in chat and stuff?
Emanator is the term that Mort Walker came up with.
Okay.
He actually wrote a kind of tongue-in-cheek lexicon of, he called it the lexicon of Comicana, and it was like a, he invented these terms for everything. You know, like a speed line was a swaloop, and he had all these great... So all those little funny things you see in comics, you know, that don't actually have names, like, he gave them all names. And Aminata was actually just a one term for one specific symbol, but we at CCS use it to refer to all of them, like things that emanate. And so what exercise I gave in the fall was, like, just as an example, an in-class exercise, everybody got a little sheet of paper that had, like, an emotion on it or a state, a physical state on it, and then they had to convey that using just symbols, like a character and symbols around that character to try to convey that state. Like, for instance, something is on the tip of your tongue. You know, like you're trying to, that thing you're trying to remember is on the tip of your tongue, so how do you show that using symbols? So there's Cartooning Studio, and then I do Thesis Seminar, which is basically like a weekly crit class of everybody's thesis project, the second-year students. And then this semester we started a new class called Writing and Drawing, which sounds like redundant with all the other classes because that's what comic school is. But the focus on this in this class, I'm co-teaching it with a writer named Sarah Stewart Taylor, and the focus is on the writing because that's the weakest part of our curriculum and also the weakest part of our students' skill set. So we are focusing on, you know, structuring stories, traditional plotting. You know, we're teaching them all the kind of ground rules that you might learn in, like, script writing or creative writing, and then, because, you know, our sort of basic approach is once you learn the ground rules and you fully grok them, then you can break those rules. So this class is all about, like, they kicked off the semester by doing a full-color 32-page Golden Age-style book. We had four different. We had an adventure book, a science fiction book, a funny animal book, and a horror book, which Steve Bissette headed up.
Surprise!
Yeah, it was actually great. Steve did the horror book. I did the adventure book. James handled science fiction, and we got Paul Karasik in to do the funny animal book.
Awesome.
And in teams of six, they had to produce a full-color 32-page comic in 2 weeks, and they kicked ass. it was great. And then now that class is focusing on a children's book. So they have 3 weeks to produce a pitch-ready dummy of a children's book. So we're kind of taking them back to square one in terms of, like, characters and story and, you know, just telling a really simple story in a really clear way. And then for the rest of the semester in that class, it's mainly going to be focused on the writing because in Cartooning Studio, they'll be doing an end-of-semester final solo project.
How has... teaching there changed your own take on comics work?
It hasn't changed my take. I mean, comics is a medium, like mm-hmm. you know, like I've been saying, of course, as you guys are also believers, like it's a medium like any other medium, and there's nothing to, like, it's just, you know, it is, it's a way of expressing yourself, and you know, whether it has commercial potential is, like, a whole other question separate from what you can do with the tools, the thing that you want to express yourself through. And, you know, it might as well be puppetry or poetry, you know. It's just a way, and if you feel moved, you do it. And the greatest thing about the school, the thing that's really had the biggest impact on me, is that it is a place where people who feel that way, people who feel that draw and feel that, like, powerful resonance, like, this is a place for them to come and pursue it full time. And the result is, like, this amazing energy. And the main thing that I've gotten out of the school has been the inspiration from all the students. And yeah, I mean, it just really feels like they're peers, you know, like we're all here, we're all making comics, we're all, like, surviving the freezing Vermont winter by hunkering down and over our drawing boards. And the greatest, I mean, you know, CCS pays me money and it's great because I have a regular job and all that, but the greatest benefit of working there is just the sheer like pleasure and energy that all of the students give off. And that is why, you know, Volume 2 of Berlin got done when it got done, because they, you know, inspired me to carry on.
They juiced you up.
Yeah, they juiced me up, exactly. And yeah. Plus, you know, I can corral them into playing Call of Cthulhu.
You see, I never actually got into the whole role-playing games.
You'd probably save, hundreds of hours of your life.
I think
it's good practice, though, for story writing, improv, and...
Oh, yeah, no, it is. It's great practice.
And creating environments and worlds.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, it's a good thing I'm not a creator. Now, we have an option right now. If you're okay, we can keep going or end at 3, because there's no show until 3:30, so we have the option. Normally we cut off at 3, but they change the schedule around, so there's no show from 3 to 3:30.
Oh,
so
wow.
We can keep going if you're up for keep going.
Sure. How long have we been going so far?
We've been going about 50 minutes.
Okay, sure.
As long as
we can end it whenever you want, just play that. Make sure to play that last song.
Oh, that will be the ending of the show.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's song. My favorite song of 2008. So.
Why don't you tell us about the song, just so people know? Before.
It's by The Music Tapes, which is essentially this guy Julian Coster, I think his name is, and he is part of the Elephant Six Collective, which. Is probably most well known for the band Neutral Milk Hotel, which was really big in the 90s. And this particular record, which came out last year, is called, I think it's called Songs for Tornadoes, Songs for Storms and Tornadoes, something like that. It's just really, raw, emotional, a lot. My girlfriend can't stand listening to it.
You know, we're not all big fans of Manifest Destiny up here.
There's nothing pretty about it, but it's like there's something true. There's something true, and that's why I like it.
That's okay. My girlfriend doesn't like Nutri-Milk Hotel, so
he's so whiny. He's always whining. Whine.
Can he just get over it?
I just did a 2-page comic on the Pig War of 1859. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You did?
Yes.
Wow.
That's Colin for us.
That's great.
Do you want to tell us about it, Colin? You feel the need. I can tell.
Oh, it's just the Manifest Destiny thing. Well, I mean, there was a period where nobody was quite sure if British Columbia was going to be part of Canada or annexed by the United States, or even some people wanted to be independent. So the Pig War was an incident in 1859 where Britain and the United States nearly went to war over a Hudson's Bay pig shot by an American settler on the San Juan Islands, which were in dispute.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been to that site. I've seen the little piggy's grave. No, there's no grave.
No, I had this memory in my mind that there was a monument to the pig.
There might be, actually. There might be.
No, there isn't. I wrote to the people, the park rangers at San Juan, and I asked them, because I have this memory. I want to know if it's true. I said, no, we take the pig war very seriously here. We don't like people making fun of it. It's like, what? You can't make fun of the pig war. What can you make fun of?
Nothing. What? So... What first sucked you into the comics world?
What?
What first sucked you into the comics world? What was the...
What was your inspiration to become a cartoonist?
I read the earliest drawings my mom has been able to find were comics. And I think that the really early exposure I had was to... I have fond memories of lots of good, illustrated kids' books that probably affected me, but... Avengers from the 1970s and Westerns, Kirby Westerns, Kid Colt, Outlaw Kid. I grew up in Montana, and but I was a university brat. My dad was a French professor, so I was surrounded by the Wild West, but, I lived a very, the life of a son of an academic. So I had a yearning for the open range and piles of flapjacks and... six shooters and ghost towns. So that stuff was an early influence. I remember before I could write or read, I would copy Avengers. There's one of you guys might remember this. There's a episode of the Avengers where Black Panther is trying to sneak into their headquarters or something. And there's all these traps that he has to pass. And, I copied that. I think when I was probably 2, I tried to copy the pages, and My mom lettered it for me, so she had really good lettering, so she was my first letterer.
You don't use her anymore.
No. Yeah, I should, though, because it's fucking tedious. But the thing that really got me, like, you know, and then I read comics all through high school, and then I thought, oh, time to put down childish things and go away to art school and get serious about this thing called art. After about a year there, I realized that the medium of choice for 95% of the people in art school was bullshit. So I rediscovered comics through Read Yourself Raw. They had that big Raw collection there. And that, like, I was like, pow, that did it. Like, now, like, it, you know, it opened up that door. Like, I thought, well, a lot of art school, you know, like, expressing yourself through it. There was a lot of incredible artists at the art school I went to. And so, you know, art, fine art itself was not something I discounted. It was just the whole gallery scene, and it was people's willingness to just, like, to just bullshit. And I wasn't interested in that. But I was sort of, at a loss. And then I found Read Yourself Raw, and that was it. Like, I was like, wow, this is it. Like, this is the way out. Like, I don't have to, like, I'm not so interested in mainstream comics at this point. I mean, I always have, like, an abiding love for, especially the old pulp, you know, the old 30s and 40s stuff, but, and a lot of the comics I grew up reading as a kid, superhero stuff, but I needed, you know, I wanted to tell other kinds of stories, and fine art was, like, an avenue to do that, but it was just so much more direct and obvious to do it using comics once I found some examples, you know, of other people doing it. Yeah. So that was huge, and then the other huge thing was Yummy Fur. Canadians, hear, listen, Canadians, hear me well, understand the power of Chester Brown.
Your father was a French professor?
French lit, actually.
Did you have any BD in the house?
We got some...
VD?
BD, bande dessinée.
Okay.
Knock.
We had Tintin and Asterix, but none of the... I didn't actually see the real stuff until there was this exchange programmer. He was a chaperone for a bunch of students, and we would go to France for, like, 6 months at a time. And so on two occasions, once when I was 9 and once when I was 15, I got to spend 6 months in Burgundy, and which was awesome. And one of the awesome things was walking into a bookstore in Paris and just being like, what? you have got to be naked ladies.
Hello, nurse.
So that was my exposure. Now, you know, I remember a Circus magazine. Do you know that one? It's this French anthology. Amazing, just incredible. I think Vittorio Giardino, actually, he ended up being a big influence on me. You can see his influence on my drawing style, I think.
No Passerai guy?
He did...
he's an Italian, right?
Jew in Communist Prague.
I have some of his stuff.
Yeah. His early... He did this thing, Sam Pezzo Private Eye, and it was like a noir...
Very sharp, clear line school.
Yeah. And very much, like, heavy photographic reference. But, like, a nice level of, you know, not so... obviously based on photographs that it gets locked down and cold. Mm-hmm. It's actually a really nice, like, it still kind of has a warmth and it still kind of moves on the page. He was a big influence on me. But that was the only real, you know, I couldn't read French and I still don't read French. So I just would just like look at the pictures and try to figure out the story.
Some of it's been translated, I hear.
Yeah, by now. But back then, you know, back then all you could get was, Asterix, and you get that. I think it was the British editions of Asterix were the ones that you'd read. But there was, I think, Little Brown in Boston was doing the Tintins in an American edition, so I was reading those.
Well, I understand that the Asterix editions, the American ones that were actually printed, were really dumbed down compared to the British ones.
Yeah, my girlfriend has at her home. She has a bunch of the British ones, and I hadn't read them since I was a kid, and I was like, they're so sophisticated. They depend on you having a British education, which is so much more sophisticated than...
Well, they have jokes in Latin.
Yeah, I failed my elocution lessons. Was Jacques Tardi someone that you got into at one point?
I never really got into him. And he's an example of somebody who, like, I really like, there was a D&Q anthology that had a story of his that I really liked in it. But I tried to read some other longer things, and I never really got into it. And the thing that really got to me about him is that, you know, his characters have that, like, dot for eye, really cartoony quality. Mm-hmm. But all the backgrounds are super, super, not, like, photorealistic, but clearly based on photographs. Like, clearly he walks around Paris and takes pictures and then writes stories set there. And that like, to me, there's, like, a disjunction there, like where I can't really engage with the story as much as I would like to. Because I love the way his art kind of looks, but then when I try to actually read it, it doesn't really do anything for me.
Hmm.
Alas, because I would love to have, you know, hundreds of pages of great comics to read.
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty already.
Yeah, there's stuff out there that I just finished, or I'm actually on the last volume of Buddha, the Tezuka. Do you know that one?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of one of those mandatory readings nowadays.
Yeah, right.
I've got the first 6 volumes sitting at home waiting for me to read them. So it seems like in your work that a sense of place is very important to you.
Yeah.
Like, when I picked up Jar of Fools, I know it's not specific a place, but it felt so much like Seattle to me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I'm just wondering why that's so important to you.
No, that's a good question. I mean, the why of that, I'm not really sure. I think that, to me, it's a part of really, if you create a believable environment or one that has a coherence, then whatever... when you put characters into that environment, I think it makes whatever they do much more, you can engage with it. Like, if the readers believe that that world is real, then they're going to follow you that much further, I think. I think I believe that's one of the reasons Hergé's work is so popular. I mean, there's probably like 3 big reasons Hergé's work is so popular. And I think that's one of them, that everything has a coherent, sensible relationship. Like when Tintin runs around on a tramp freighter in the Red Sea, you know, like he's running from very specific place to very specific place. Like it's all physically related and it all makes sense. And I think that that's always been really, really important to me. And I just figured it out. And this is like the 18th place I've lived since I've become an adult. So I've moved around a lot, and, maybe it's a kind of wistful desire to just be in one place for a long period of time. But it's just it's really, really important to me. But I couldn't necessarily describe exactly why.
Now, I guess this is kind of a prerequisite expected question. Magic. Magicians.
Yeah.
Sleight of hand. Where did that come from for you?
That came out of when I was, I think I was in my last year at RISD, Rhode School of Design, was where I went to art school. And a friend of mine, I can't remember how Houdini came up, but something happened. I guess we decided to do a mini comic. We did like 19 mini comics, some friends and I, when I was in school. And one of them was about Houdini, and I can't remember which one of us settled on it. It's probably my friend Jake, who... there's this zine called Rocktober. Have you ever heard of that? It's this rock and roll magazine. My friend Jake Austin now makes.
But I celebrate Rocktober every October.
Good. Good for you. He'd be very happy. He also used to run a great kiddie dance show in Chicago called Chick-a-Go-Go, which is kids dancing around to, you know, the tunes of, like punk rock bands. It's a really great show. You can watch it.
Sounds like a vision of hell.
It's pretty amazing stuff. I think he was the one who really dug Houdini, and Jake's Jewish, and Houdini, of course, is like this kind of amazing Jew. And I just started reading about it, and I was like, wow. I always knew his name. I didn't really know much about him, and I just became kind of fascinated. And when I started writing Jar of Fools, so there was no, I was never a magician as a kid, and I never had any kind of lasting, and, you know, I don't really think that much about magic these days, but when I started writing Jar of Fools, and it was improvisational, it was one page at a time, and at first, the main character shows up in a tuxedo, he's in a dream, and he's dancing, like, at a fancy dress ball with his girlfriend, And he wakes up from his dream, and he's sitting on this park bench in his tuxedo with a sprung collar. And I didn't know that he was a magician at that point. He was just a guy in a tuxedo. And then the Native American sitting next to him on the bench asks him for change, and he does a little trick where he turns a quarter into like a $5 bill, I think. And that's the point at which he became a magician. And then magic became like a theme of the book, and I started to read magic books and practice tricks and just try to, like, because there was some, I knew there was some reason my subconscious was pushing me that way, and I didn't really, I just sort of trusted it and trusted that that should be part of the book, but it didn't come out of any kind of long-standing interest. It sort of came out of character sitting on a park bench. And then I think, it just sort of became metaphorical for different aspects of the story, and the kind of less described those aspects are, the better, because that's the whole point of a metaphor. like, I read a lot of, you guys read any, you ever read any Haruki Murakami? The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, or... he's a really, really great Japanese author, and one of the wonderful things about his books is that there's all this metaphorical language. They're very grounded stories about people doing things, very concrete physical things. There's a lot of suggestion and metaphor, but the great thing about his stories is you never know what the metaphors mean. and they're just these kind of poetic suggestions, and that to me is kind of the perfect model for using that kind of stuff. So the magic in Jar of Fools, it like means stuff, but the meaning is not something I could articulate. You know, it's something that hopefully comes through the way people use it or relate to one another.
Yeah, beginning to sound like art school.
I never stop.
How is the difference for you writing a comic, as in just writing, like how you did with the Houdini book with Bertuzzi, as is for writing and illustrating? Is it a weight off your shoulders?
It is. Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. The drawing is like punching the clock. You know, the drawing is the hard, the heavy lifting. It's the hard labor. The writing is the part where, I feel like that's the kind of construction of the comic is, I think, where my strength really lies. And it's, in a way, it's the sort of invisible part. It's the part that nobody really notices. It's the what images you choose to put right next to each other, and how big you make the panels and how you pace it. And so writing that book for Nick to draw was really, really great, because I could just focus on that and then I could hand it off to him. And I'm doing that now with we're working on an Amelia Earhart book, and I'm doing the same thing with Ben Toll, who did this book Midnight Sun. and that process of that's the writing for me, and it's not just writing dialogue or writing a script. It's actually, you make a diagram of the page, and you stage it, and you figure out what's going to go in every panel, and so you see the visuals, and you're working it out. And, the page is a unit, like a paragraph, and you're trying to figure out not only what happens on the page spread, but after you turn a page, the physical motion of turning the page is a really important part of reading a comic book, more so than reading a prose book. Mm-hmm. It's actually a really integral part of the mechanics of how a comic book works. So all that stuff is, playing around with that and using it to the best advantage is what I really enjoy. And so writing that book for Nick to draw was really, really great. And then I thought, let's see, this is the first time I'd ever written something for somebody else to draw. And I thought, well, this is going to be kind of tough to hand it over to someone and then, like, hope that they can deliver, and he better stick to my script. and then what Nick did was, there were many instances where he changed the basic layout of the panel or changed the camera angle, et cetera, and always for the better. So it was really, really great that way, because I learned stuff, I thought, oh, well, I never would have made that decision, but look how it improves that, that scene. So that was just a good, lucky thing. And I think that part of the reason is that in some way, Nick and I, there's like a connection that we work well together, and we have a lot of the same feelings about how comics can be used. And I had the same experience when I drew a book called The Fall with Ed Brubaker. Mm-hmm. He wrote it, and he's since gone on to write Batman, and he's the guy that killed Captain America, and
Actually, bless it's him. Probably the editor that's the one that killed Captain America.
Yeah, probably. I like to think that's an arrow in Ed's quiver, or out of his quiver now, I guess. and he wrote this book for me to draw, and then and that experience was also really, really great because I was seeing how, you know, he approaches this story much more, whereas I was describing working on Berlin, and it's a very exploratory process. Ed is much more of a structuralist, and he'll figure it all out ahead of time and figure out who needs to do what when, and you know, like he's good at writing like a mystery where it all has to kind of fit and work really well. So that was really great experience from the other end of it, where I was taking his script and I was still doing the breakdowns, like figuring out what goes on every page. But I was having this pre-existing structure that I was having to adapt, and that was really, really great too for different reasons. So far those collaborations have worked out great. I have yet to have a bad collaboration.
Now, I've heard there's plans to re-release The Fall. Is that true?
Yeah, it's been in the works for a while. It's been optioned, and it's been actually David Goyer, who's the guy that wrote The Dark Knight. wait, is that the last Batman movie? Was that The Dark Knight?
Yeah.
So he wrote that, and he sort of worked his way up through the ranks, but he actually has the rights to making the film out of that, and Ed's worked on the script, and it's just been sitting. But you know, it's like it would be like a pretty low budget, you know, B thriller sort of. So I don't expect him to get to that anytime soon, because he's doing like Batman and vampire movies and stuff. But it's out there, and we've been wanting to put it back in print for a long time, and Ed's hoping to do that sometime this year, later this year, I hope. We shopped it around the book, but we tried to go through actual book publishers, and it's just kind of a hard package to sell. It's like 48 pages. You can't really make it square bound, and so we're trying to explore our options, but we really want to put that back in print because it's like some of the best art I've ever done. So
I've got my copy.
You have a copy?
Yeah.
It's very, very rare. It's very hard to come by.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. You really can't find them.
Wow.
It's part of the death of the floppies.
Yeah, right.
Are you still going to be putting out the Little Berlins?
As long as B&Q lets me. You know, if I can carry that through to the end, that would be great, because those little chapters are sort of important to me. And there's a whole color scheme thing plays out over the whole series that I want to follow through on, but maybe it'll become financially untenable. I don't know.
You want to finish the swastika?
Yeah, right. Well, all you need is like four issues, and you got a swastika. So,
oh, okay.
It's more the there's a color shift that occurs over the whole 24 chapters that I'd like to see followed through.
A slow change.
Yes.
You know what? I feel we're nearing the end of our time.
Okay.
I feel good with the questions we've asked. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
My pleasure. It's great talking to you guys.
Colin.
Oh, it's been fun.
Good talking to you, Colin. I haven't talked to you since I saw you in Vancouver like 15 years ago, I think. But glad to know you're doing well.
Oh, I'm doing okay.
Or whatever as well as.
As Colin gets. Yeah.
God, were you at that party? I remember, I have a memory of Ed Brubaker getting really drunk and taking Kim Thompson at Fantagraphics to task for the Comics Journal not being as supportive of emerging cartoonists as they should be.
I was at that party, yeah, indeed.
That was like in South Seattle?
You know, was it in South Seattle? Yeah. I remember it being in the University District, but I definitely... No, you're right. You know, maybe it was in South Seattle. I think it was at Russ's house, yeah.
Yeah.
The guy that used to run Fallout, the great skate and comic store.
Yep, that's
yep,
the one.
Yep, Ed totally... Yep, it was pretty great.
Actually,
he got totally wasted and then yelled at Kim Thompson for a while.
Actually, I thought it was quite a good little speech.
It was a great little speech.
It was a good tirade.
You know, I also got to say Kim Thompson is actually... A good guy, so I don't want to. I don't want to.
Oh no, I really admire Kim Thompson. He's incredibly hardworking.
He is incredibly hardworking, and a very even keeled guy too.
Mm-hmm.
He just sort of stood there and took it.
well, he took it with a smile, but it just seemed like it was Ed was
Well, it's not even Kim's not the one that does the journal anyways. That's Gary's.
Right. But no, yeah, it was articulating something that a lot of people felt, which is that Fantagraphics wasn't really, you know, doing what they could. But, well, of course, they were doing what they could.
So it's 15 years ago.
The problem with the Comics Journal is that it was critical. It was critiquing comics, and people thought that they should just be comics boosters.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, maybe that was the...
Was this back when Chris Brayshaw was pissing everyone off?
I think this is before Chris Brayshaw was pissing everyone off. This is like the, what, the 80s, 90s?
It would be the 90s.
Yeah, it was the 90s. Yeah.
The 80s was a long time ago now, Colin.
My guess is that somebody wrote something bad about one of Ed's early comics. And that he had to let him have it.
But. Yeah.
Anyway, enough about the...
We don't need to digress upon
Seattle in the 90s, parties of our youth.
Yeah, I'm going to go and listen to some Soundgarden and Pearl Jam now and smoke from my big bong.
You ever actually been to the Soundgarden?
I have, yeah.
The band was named after the Soundgarden, which is an audio sculpture beside Lake Union in Seattle.
Oh.
Yeah.
I will have to check that out next time I'm down there.
It's a real thing.
It exists.
And there's also Mud Honey if you look in the right place.
Where's that?
I'm just kidding.
I think I got some earlier. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
And
nice talking to you.
Yeah.
And take care. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Jason Lutz, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Jason. And this has been an extended... Ink Studs. I hope we get the sound thing fixed. Colin's ears are ringing.
Sorry, it's been so long since I had the headphones on for that long.
We'll have to teach you how to rock out to headphones all day long, Colin.
I'm rocking.
He's rocking kind of oddly. CITR 101.9 FM, Ink Studs. Next week, I'll be playing an interview I did with funny man John Kirschbaum, one of New York's finest. Pete and Pussy is his book for Fantagraphics. And you don't know it, Colin?
No.
It's funny.
It's about a
dog and a cat who have the heads of old men and the temperament of old men.
Somebody else was doing that. Was doing a similar strip back in the 90s. God, was from Chicago. Can't remember his name. Anyway.
You sure it wasn't the other way around?
No, it was dogs with people heads. And this was some guy back in like the small press days back in the 90s.
Sure it wasn't John Kirschbaum? Late 90s, probably?
Maybe.
He did get some Xerox Award, Grants and stuff. So, as well as Jason, I think, got Xerox Grants to do his first Jar of Fools books, if I remember right, Jason Lutz, who was
these are them, so.
Yeah, Colin's going to look. Next week, John Kirschbaum, and I had quite a good time talking to John, and the week after will be an interview with Chris Forges. I did with him, and just waiting to get a music selection from him. Chris, if you're listening. Give me music.
Zurich.
There we go. Wonderful Zurich. Chris, pen name CF, his books Power Masters 1 and 2 from Picturebox, as well as a whole array of anthologies from Picturebox. And he's in most of the Kramer's Ragazza 4, 5, 6, and the wonderful 7, which can be used to beat down a neighbor if they're pissing you off. Have you seen this book, Colin?
Yeah, it's huge. You could use it as a boogie board.
You could. And I am tempted. If it wasn't so awesome. It's an incredible book. And
what, $125?
Yeah, that would be a waste of $125. Then again, boogie boards can be pretty expensive. Next month, I've setting up some interviews. Nate Powell, whose book, Swallow Me Whole, as well, Songs of Your Name. Swallow Me Whole has been getting a lot of attention as a book of the year from a lot of folks last year from Top Shelf as well. I'm going to be yakking with the boys behind Podaki. Podaki? I'm going to find out how to pronounce that.
It's a wonderful little art book from Drawing Quarterly, and we're looking at maybe them coming to do a little thing at Lucky's, so we'll coincide with that. And Colin has an announcement to make.
Oh, I just wanted to mention I'll be in a group show at the Gem Gallery Saturday. It's the Dirty Show. Some very nice art in it. This is the closing party. We had the opening at Pat's Pub, and nobody showed up, so you better show up to this one.
Yeah, I don't go down to Pat's Pub.
Well, this is at the Gem Gallery, much nicer venue, and there's actually some really nice art, and it's all filthy, filthy, filthy.
Yeah, Colin's piece is a little disturbing.
You haven't seen Bob Scott's Franken penis.
Franken-dong. Let's call it Franken-dong.
Franken-dong. Yeah, that's deeply disturbing.
What day is this on?
This is on Saturday.
Saturday. Maybe I'll do a pop-by. A Popeye, if I leave my couch.
This is, for those who don't know, the Gem, this is, I guess you call your lowbrow art.
I hate the term.
Yes, but it's one people understand. Some people.
You keep perpetuating the usage. I'm also going to be trying to connect with a lot of local artists and illustrators, some of whom may get that term thrust upon them, of which I go... Patosh! There's better words. How about just Badoodles?
Patosh?
Patosh.
That's the last Battle of the Riel Rebellion.
And that's why I say that, Colin.
Okay.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And French Connection, I think, is the next show up. So talk to you all later.
And the last song is?
Oh, where was it, Colin? Oh, yeah, Colin. Manifest Destiny by the Music Tapes. There we go. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cause you